Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to the Mid-Coast Forum at Point Lookout in Northport for a talk by Anna Borshevskaya. She's the Ira Weiner Fellow at the Washington Institute. Borshevskaya gives us a brief history of what drives Russian relations, and then she discusses what's next for Russia's relationship with its own citizens, the Middle East, and the world at large. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it'll be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to hear the program again at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. And as always, the program will be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is George Look, president of the Mid-Coast Forum.
So good afternoon. Welcome to the November meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. Both to our guests and members who are here today and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 404th meeting of the forum and comes to you today from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, the president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 and is now in its 35th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum is honored today to have Anna Borshevskaya speaking on Russia, What's Next? Ms. Borshevskaya is the Ira Weiner Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy in Washington, D.C., where she focuses on Russia's policy toward the Middle East. In addition, she is a fellow at the European Foundation for Democracy. She was previously with the Peterson Institute for International Economics and the Atlantic Council, is a former analyst for a U.S. military contractor in Afghanistan, and has served as communications director at the American Islamic Congress. Ms. Borshevskaya's analysis is published widely in journals such as The New Criterion, Turkish Policy Quarterly, and the Middle East Quarterly. She also conducts translation and analysis for the U.S. Army's Foreign Military Studies Office and its flagship publication, Operational Environment Watch. She writes a foreign affairs column in Forbes. Originally from Moscow, Ms. Borshevskaya came to the United States as a refugee in 1993. She has a Master of Arts in International Relations from the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and a Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Science and International Relations from the State University of New York at Geneseo. Ms. Borshevskaya, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here today and to speak to you on a topic that interested me for many years before Putin's intervention in Syria in September 2015. I want to make a couple of points up front. I'm going to break my talk into two sections, because I think to understand what Russia is doing in the Middle East, it's first important to understand Russia itself. So first I'll talk about Russia and certain relevant elements of Russian history in the region, and then I'll turn to its activities in the Middle East. Russia in the Middle East might seem like a new phenomenon. In fact, I remember Putin's intervention in Syria took many by surprise, including those who remember the Cold War. But there was nothing new about it. There's frankly nothing new about Putin himself. The seeds of what was to come in Georgia in 2008, then Ukraine in 2014, and then Syria the next year, were there from the very beginning of Putin's regime. What's happening to Russia today, I think, is in many ways a continuation of centuries-old traditions and issues that haven't been fully resolved. Many historians have made the point that the Soviet Union is still collapsing, it's still crumbling, and I think that remains quite true. So Imperial Russia and its successor, the Soviet Union, were both major players in the Middle East. Russia's very identity developed in close contact with Islam and also influenced this development in a certain way. Many talk about Russia as a European country or a Western country, but Russia has struggled with its identity for much of its existence and continues to do so today, and it's this identity crisis that is one of the themes of my talk. First, very briefly, I just want to go over a few major historical points in Russia's history. And Russia has four: the Muscovite legacy, the Kievan Rus, the Grand Duchy of Muscovy, the Tsarist or later Imperial Russia, and then the Soviet Union. The Muscovite Kievan Rus was a first Eastern Slavic state, and it was a thriving cultural center and a Western one. When the Mongols invaded Kievan Rus and eventually defeated it and left it under Tatar control, it left the Rus fractured and more Eastern. And this happened before the creation of the Russian state. It left the Rus deeply traumatized. As historian Sergei Plohy actually has written in a recent book, as the Russian state began asserting its sovereignty under Ivan III, he crushed a democratic rival, a Novgorod Republic, which sought to distance itself from the Golden Horde. It had an assembly and a much more democratic way of governance than what the Muscovy tried to do. So that laid the foundation for the state and for what later became the Tsardom of Russia. I should say fear of Islam persists in Russia to this day, which added to the fervor with which the Russian state historically pursued the spread of Russian Orthodox faith. They back then in those years, people talked about overthrowing the Tatar yoke. And it's the Mongol invasions that laid the foundation for that. When the Tsardom of Russia was created, an idea resonated well with the founders of the state, such as Ivan the Terrible, and that is an idea of Russia as the Third Rome. Incidentally, some also referred to Moscow as another Jerusalem, but really it was the comparison to Rome that attracted the most attention. And in fact, the word Tsar was derived from Caesar, from the word Caesar. At the time, there were some writings that talked about Moscow being the Third Rome in a sense that with the fall of the First Rome and then the Second Rome, that is Constantinople, after it fell to the Turks in 1453, Moscow remained as the third and final Rome. There was a Russian Orthodox philosopher who wrote at the time that there will be no other. This will be the last one. And by the time we arrive to the Russian Empire, beginning of the 18th century, several features of the Russian state had emerged. One was this long-standing historical identity crisis that I mentioned before, the East or West, which remains unresolved today. One Russian philosopher, Nikolai Berdyaev, wrote, "The Russian people are not purely European, and it's not purely Asiatic. Russia is a complete section of the world, a colossal east-west. It unites two worlds, and within the Russian soul, two principles are always engaged in strife, the Eastern and the Western." This is one of Putin's favorite people to quote. And he uses these types of writings to justify a dichotomy. It's either authoritarianism or chaos. There can be nothing in between. So Putin looks to Russian history, and he cherry-picks such writings to justify his rule. Another feature of Imperial Russia that emerged was the assertion of Russian exceptionalism, which was different from American. It was the idea of cultural uniqueness and a civilizational mission that has often served for the Russian leaders, Russian rulers, as a political, cultural, and social reaction. They used it to justify war, imperial expansion, and very importantly, a diversion from economic difficulties and a way to cover up the incompetence of the ruling officials. Essentially, it was to ensure the survival of the ruling regime. And I want to highlight this point because, again, much of what's happening today, what's happening in Syria, is another manifestation of a ruler who is trying to ensure the survival of his regime. Another feature that emerged in the Russian Empire was that, so according to this myth of Russia as the Third Rome, anointed as this divine successor, Russian borders that said were not clearly defined. And this provided another justification for the government to expand. this expansion was different from Western empires, because there was no distinction between the ruling core and the colonies. And this ties also to identity issues. As English historian Geoffrey Hosking wrote, Great Britain had an empire, but Russia was an empire. Western European states developed identities separate from their colonies. This didn't happen in Russia. Some historians have argued that Russia was never a nation state, but developed from its very origins as an empire. Another element of Imperial Russia was a centralized and militarized state. So one of the pillars that held the state was orthodoxy and autocracy, and sort of a distant third was nationalism. But the centralization and militarization were very important features. And the government also held a deeply ingrained sense of territorial insecurity and a fear of invasion. Russia's geography, flat land, made it indeed quite susceptible. And so an imperative for security drove a lot of militaristic and economic development. In fact, some historians believe that it was the geography of Eurasia that drove expansion eastward, similar to the Golden Horde of Tamerlane, to drive the Russian state to create this huge continental empire. But this need to expand also became self-perpetuating, because as the empire conquered new lands, new territories, and it absorbed new peoples and nationalities, it questioned their loyalties. And it felt it needed more buffer zones to protect themselves. In fact, Catherine the Great had a very, very famous quote. She said, "I have no better way to defend my borders than to expand them." And this idea played out over and over again in Russian history, and then in Soviet history as well. But so this insecurity, in turn, also brought on more repressions by the state, because it was the state that felt insecure, and so it sought more territories, more buffer zones, and in a sense, expansion and growth was an outcome of weakness of the state, not so much its strength. Because, frankly, these vast territories were very hard to govern. They imposed huge bureaucratic burdens on the people. Administration was very difficult. And so expansion often brought poverty to the people, not wealth. But at the same time, Russia became a major player in European politics. It had large territory. It had a large population. It had the ability to mobilize armed forces. It had a huge wealth of natural resources. So it was a force too formidable to ignore in European politics. And another feature that emerged at that time was competition with the West. And here's where I want to turn to the East. Imperial Russia made a major push to the East. In the 19th century, there were extensive conquests in that region. So they began expanding southward towards the Caspian, the Black Seas, and the Caucasus. Russia fought two wars with Iran. Relations actually began between Russia and Iran in the 1500s, but it's the expansion that caused their interests to clash. And Iran lost both wars to the Russians. They conquered the historically Iranian South Caucasus, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. The North Caucasus especially resisted the Russian rule, and the Russian czars and later Stalin treated them particularly brutally. These territories took much longer to conquer and to incorporate into the Russian Empire, and even so, they always remained resistant, and whenever the state was at its weakest, they always looked for ways to rebel, and so the Kremlin was always worried about rebellion from this region, and in fact, because of this, most likely, in 1864, Tsar Alexander II forcefully expelled the vast majority of the Circassians, primarily to the Ottoman Empire. To this day, the Circassians expel that date as a date of genocide. And of course, there was also expansion to Central Asia. Imperial Russia had extensive relations with the Middle East, and it had many interests in that region. Remember, this was geographically very close. This was not far away, distant land. This was right next to the country. So the interests were geostrategic, they were economic, and they were also cultural. Access to the Mediterranean Sea was very important for the Kremlin, because having a link for Russia to the region, especially through a south warm water ports, this is something Russia sought beginning with Peter the Great, at least. And it continues to play out today again, and I'll talk about it when I turn to Russia and Syria. Imperial Russia was also concerned with preventing the expansion of Turkey and Iran. And they practice soft power. They build diplomatic and cultural ties in the region, especially in Syria and Palestine. They wanted to build constituencies in which they could later rely on for support, and it's something that the Soviet Union would do as well in the region. And of course, Russia was part of the great game with England in Iran and Afghanistan. In 1774, Russia and Turkey signed a treaty called Kuchuk-Kainaranji, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, which ended the Russo-Turkish War and ended the unchallenged Ottoman control of the Black Sea. It also provided a diplomatic basis for future Russian intervention in internal affairs of the Ottoman Empire. And a number of territorial provisions of that treaty extended the Russian frontier. The treaty had a commercial provision also that gave Russia the right to establish consulates in the Ottoman Empire and to navigate freely in its waters through the Strait of Bosphorus and Dardanelles and to enjoy commercial privileges in the empire. Most historians, though, what they describe a much more far-reaching and relevant consequence was a religious stipulation that gave Russia the right to represent within the Ottoman Empire the Greek Orthodox Christians within certain territories. Essentially, later, Russia interpreted that and used this provision to support its claims to protect over the Greek Orthodox Christians anywhere in the Ottoman Empire. Later, another important event came in May 1916 with the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the secret Britain-France pact that reached during the First World War that proposed splitting the Middle East into zones of foreign control. In 1916, as you know, this was close to the Bolshevik Revolution, and the Bolsheviks had leaked the text of the agreement to newspapers as Vestia and Pravda in November 1917, in fact, just about 100 years today. And this caused great embarrassment to Western allies and help create a rift, a growing distrust between them and the Arabs, which most likely is what the Bolsheviks were seeking. Of course, then Russia became the Soviet Union in 1922, and the Soviet Union had a very strong presence in the Middle East. The Bolsheviks, I should say themselves, were a most radical group that initially had very little support. They used violent terrorist tactics, and they learned from other previous violent Russian groups, eventually they won over the country. The Soviet Union held on two pillars. It held on lies and brutality. According to some press reports at the time, even the Nazis reportedly envied how well the Bolsheviks carried out their propaganda, and they tried to emulate it. It is through that brutality that lies that they held power. Of course, internally, the Soviet Union suppressed all religion. There were token Islamic and other bodies that were tolerated in the Caucasus and Central Asia. But in February 1944, Joseph Stalin deported about almost 1.5 million people from the North Caucasus, mainly the Chechens, under the false guise of Nazi collaboration. And this is, again, because of supposedly, I'm not sure if it's true, supposedly Stalin said they could have rebelled if they just had a chance. And this helped shape Chechen identity as such. This is something that would play out several decades later in Russian history. But prior to these horrific deportations that resulted in the deaths of probably at least a third of deportees, if not more, these people began to identify themselves as Chechen as opposed to just belonging to a clan. But in the Middle East, from the non and the Soviet times, the Kremlin was guided by the Soviet ideology of the spread of communism. and hoped they hoped to reduce Western influence in the region. So again, there's this element of competition with the West, albeit different from Imperial Russia, but competition nonetheless. And so all policies were aimed at pushing out the West from that region. So the Soviet Union propped up authoritarian regimes in Egypt and Syria, had relations with Iraq, somewhat strong relations with Libya, and so forth. They groomed elites in these countries. They came to Moscow, especially Syrians and Egyptians. According to what I've seen, something between 40 to 50,000 Syrians had studied in the Soviet Union in the most elite schools. The Kremlin really considered the Syrians to be their closest allies in the Arab world. There were many intermarriages between Russians and Syrians. Russians sent advisors. They helped build their chemical weapons arsenal and so forth. This was a very special relationship. So I would argue that out of all the countries in the region, this was the most special one. That's not to say they didn't have relations with other countries, but this was by far the strongest. And frankly, I traveled to Syria in 2008, and even in those years, people still remembered the Soviet Union, and they talked about it as a great power, that image of greatness that it still invokes in them.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. We're at the Midcoast Forum at Point Lookout in Northport, where Anna Borshevskaya is discussing what's next for Russia.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia briefly retreated from the Middle East under Boris Yeltsin, who frankly had, he was focused more on domestic priorities. Personally, by many accounts, he simply had no interest in the region. He wanted to do other things. But Russia was going through what was supposed to be a transition to democracy, and many in the West thought it was. But that's not what really happened. Russia was very weak economically, grew weaker, unemployment grew higher, there was endemic poverty, crime and corruption, and of course the rise of the oligarchs. Liberals and pro-Westerners, I would argue, remained a minority because so many people from the ruling communist regime just turned around the next day and said that they were communists. So while the Russian people truly wanted change, this was a moment in Russian history where they wanted freedom, they wanted democracy. They didn't know what it was, and they never experienced it. And the people who came to power were predominantly not the Democrats. Russia never went through a true reconciliation process to truly reckon with its bloody Soviet past, the way, for example, Nazi Germany had done. And so when the Russian people saw what was happening in that decade, they said, well, if this is truly what democracy is supposed to be, we don't want any because it's chaos. The one thing that Russia did have at the time, for the first time, was free press. Mainly because Yeltsin tolerated it. When Yeltsin fought a war with Chechnya, the Russian people for the first time saw what their government was doing. This was supposed to be a quick and easy war. Yeltsin's advisors, in fact, at the time thought that that's what it would be. And part of their rationale, in fact, was that a quick and easy war would boost Yeltsin's falling ratings. So I just want to bring that idea and how that idea echoes back to Catherine the Great, to, frankly, another Russian advisor in 1904, who also said to the Tsar back then, we need a quick and easy war. And that's what led back then to a war with Japan, which was neither quick nor easy. And so it's in this context that eventually Vladimir Putin, at the time a largely unknown, opaque former KGB officer, became prime minister. Back in 1999, there was another major event I just want to highlight. There were a number of major terrorist attacks, explosions in Moscow and several other cities. Putin back then immediately blamed the Chechens. even though analysts at the time raised questions and evidence of Moscow's possible complicity in these events, they questioned, frankly, if Chechnya even had the capabilities to launch such an attack. Many times the Russian government would refer to this incident as their September 11th. The difference is, in this particular event in Russia, those responsible were never found, and there's a lot of questions that remain, especially in the minds of the Russian people, as to what really happened. When Putin was elected in 2000, two things helped propel him into power. One was a strong anti-terrorism stance in the wake of these of these horrible attacks. And if he had a famous slogan in Russian, it was "Machit v sartire," which means "I will wipe them out in the outhouse." And another was television. Television that helped help spread his message. Media, I want to highlight this point too, because use of propaganda, use of media, this is something that plays an enormous role in Russia. It played it from the very beginning. So Putin promised to bring stability and growth. And implicitly, he struck a bargain with the Russian people, stability in exchange for staying out of politics. We have the West, that is, when I say we, it's the West. The West largely moved on since the end of the Cold War. We thought the Cold War was over. But many people in the Kremlin did not, nor have they shed their authoritarian past. And Putin had a very clear vision. He was, again, an unknown entity at the time. But if you look back at his early speeches, his writings, he pursued a vision very consistently, even if more cautiously in the early years, that he continues to pursue to this day. For example, you know, he talked about the ideas of certain countries stepping up their efforts to weaken Russia. Very early documents talked about the need to return to the Middle East as early as 2000. And, of course, blaming the West for the perceived Russian humiliation of the 1990s. All of these ideas, they all echo a man named Yevgeny Primakov, who held a number of positions in the Russian government, including intelligence services, and he briefly served as prime minister. And Primakov knew the Middle East very well. He spoke Arabic. He felt that Russia's image as a great power has to be restored in the Middle East and elsewhere. He pursued a vision of what he called a multipolar world. So when Putin talks about multipolar world, he echoes Primakov. It's the same idea that goes all the way back to that era. And Primakov was also chiefly concerned with curbing NATO expansion and Western democratization efforts. So again, these are all Putin's goals. So Putin worked from the very beginning quietly to bring Russia back to the Middle East. His approach differed in many respects from the Soviet Union. One is that Moscow no longer had an ideology, so it would no longer give anything for free. Instead, Putin pursued relations with virtually everybody in the region, whether they were a traditional enemy or traditional adversary. And relations became primarily interest-based. But second, Putin focused on building political and diplomatic support in key countries through arms and energy sales and trade. Another major event happened very early on, and that is Ukraine's Orange Revolution, and for which if Putin immediately blamed the West. He was convinced the West was behind these protests. If you listen to what he says over and over again about these events, he can't even conceive that people could do this on their own. I mean, I actually think he genuinely believes this, because I think just as we project ourselves onto other people, well, he projects himself to us. And for a former KGB man, this is what, if he wanted to destabilize a country, this is what he would do. So I think it's no surprise that he blames all anti-authoritarian protests on the West. Frankly, I think Putin believes there's no real democracy anywhere, and this is why he always said from the very beginning he's no different from us. So in the Middle East, the way this played out, of course, was the Arab Spring. Putin also felt that the West was behind the Arab Spring protests, and by then, we're talking about 2010, Russia had already invaded Georgia at the time, And Putin was looking for ways, again, to sustain his regime. The satisfaction, frankly, was growing against him. And in fact, in late 2011, early 2012, major protests broke out in Russia against Putin. He blamed Hillary Clinton for these protests. He said she gave the signal for protesters to come out. When he saw Arab Spring, I think he saw himself. He saw that this is what could happen to him if he doesn't get on the offensive. He annexed Crimea in 2014, for example, at a time when his approval ratings were at their lowest. And at least temporarily, there was a spike to a very large high. I remain skeptical to the accuracy of these polls because, to a very large extent, they're engineered. But there's no question that he whipped up a lot of nationalism, a lot of feelings of patriotism to distract people from their problems. By the time September 2015 came about, to be frank, Putin needed another distraction, and Assad was losing ground in Syria. And the U.S. signaled it had no major interest in intervening. And he read the situation correctly. Frankly, I think if he felt the U.S. would put the strength of its military force, he would be a little bit more hesitant. But before coming into Syria, he already had a major presence in the country. He protected Assad from the very beginning that protests broke out against Assad in March 2011. Again, think about it. It's all Arab Spring, all of these events, and Putin looking at what might happen to him. So he protected Assad on the UN Security Council. He protected Assad through loans, through advisors, through basically any means possible. Russia had, as I'm sure many people here are aware, the only naval facility outside the former Soviet Union in Tartus. Strategically, this was extremely important for Russia to protect. Again, this was a warm water port. Think back to Peter the Great. One quick element I just want to briefly highlight how Russia protected Assad on the UN was through its engagement in the Geneva talks and Geneva peace talks. In 2012, a document came out called the Geneva Communique that outlined a transitional process, which was supposed to outline the future of Syria, which envisioned, at least in spirit, Assad's departure. The Kremlin pushed for its own version of a language that was much more opaque about what types of opposition groups can be included in transitional government, and this allowed Moscow to engage those types of oppositions, those members of the opposition who did not demand Assad's departure. So technically, this was under the auspices of the UN and its multilateralism, which is what Putin likes to pay lip service to. But this was slowly laying the groundwork for protecting Assad through this body. So by the time Putin intervened, it, frankly, in a way, it was surprising, but at the same time, it wasn't. So much had happened quietly behind the scenes that it's no wonder he went in to support Assad. He said he went in Syria to fight ISIS so that these fighters didn't return to Russia. But Moscow's actions showed that it had no interest in fighting ISIS. They bombed everybody, frankly, but ISIS. What they instead wanted to do was to put the West in front of a choice. It's either ISIS or Assad in Syria. And if you're faced with that choice, then of course you're going to choose Assad. So many other interests culminated when Syria, the restoration of perception of Russia as a great power, ability to counterbalance the West, distract the Russian public from domestic problems. For a while, Syria was all you could see in the Russian news. People who had never heard of Syria before could all of a sudden name cities, know the minutest details about the country. They tried to justify their intervention, frankly, with Russian history again in this region. In fact, even tried to tie Russia's development as a state to Syria. If you look at Russia's military moves, the way they positioned their military equipment, the type of equipment they brought was designed to limit Western ability to maneuver. So they brought naval and air forces. Well, ISIS doesn't have an air force, so why are you bringing an air force? In military terms, what they've done through positioning their weaponry, it's called an A2AD, or anti-access denial bubbles. When you position a weapon, a defensive weapon, that would prevent anyone else from intervening. This hasn't fully happened because the West still has the ability to operate, but we now think twice, and that's a tangible achievement of the intervention. So that, rather than in protecting Assad, were the real reasons for the intervention, certainly not fighting ISIS. But very briefly, I just want to say that Russia's relations with Iran have really arrived to new heights that we've never seen before. And Syria was one of the reasons why these two traditional rivals have come so close together. And going forward in terms of the future, one question is how will the Russia-Iran relationship play out in the months and years ahead? Analysts tend to focus on the rivalry between these two countries, and indeed Iranians don't trust the Russians for a lot of reasons. But I'm skeptical that the Russia-Iran alliance is going to break anytime soon because they have a common enemy, and that's the West. And they've been very good at putting their differences aside for the time being. So I certainly, you know, in terms of going forward, I don't see a split anytime soon. What we also see happening in Syria is Putin trying to, on the one hand, extricate himself from the conflict, but at the same time keep Russia's presence there. Most recently he talked about wrapping up Russia's military operations there. I'm quite skeptical that's going to happen. If it is, it might be short-term and tactical. But keep in mind, Russia now has a Russian military presence in Syria for the next 49 years through its latest agreements with the Tartus naval base and the Khmeimim air base. So the Russian military is not going anywhere. What Putin doesn't want is to invest a lot of resources into Syria. He wants someone else to pay. But as far as Russian presence, I think that's pretty permanent. I think we should have no illusions about that. And Russian energy companies have started entering certain key areas of Syria, which I think also tells you a little bit about his intentions. He wants to control Syria's energy infrastructure. Looking beyond the region, I don't think that Syria might necessarily be the last gambit, because if you want to have these short interventions that temporarily rally people around the flag, these emotions, they don't last. You need something else to sustain that momentum. Another possible area for another, perhaps not as major intervention, but something along those lines, could be Libya. So that's another country to watch, where there's a lot of instability, where Russia has been heavily supporting General Khalifa Haftar, who actually studied in the Soviet Union. He's visited Moscow several times. At the same time, the Russians have also been keeping contacts with other actors on the scene. But what they've also been doing is laying the groundwork for saying that that ISIS can take hold in Libya. The West has proven incompetent. That could create another opportunity for them to intervene in some capacity. So Russia's presence in this country is certainly important to watch. And Russia in the rest of the North Africa, Egypt, a traditional historic client, of course, but also Algeria, Tunisia, and even Morocco. What's happening in all of North African region is a slow building, growing influence. And in each country, it's a little bit different, and it's more present in one than the other. But Putin said at least a year ago that Africa, and the entire African continent, I should say, not just North Africa, is too important to be considered on the periphery of international relations. So that also tells you about where he's looking forward. So the North African region is important to watch. One last point I just want to make on Syria. We don't talk about it enough. But the other outcome of the Syria intervention has been an increase of refugee flows into Europe, which helped to stabilize Europe. Putin himself, of course, didn't start this problem, but he capitalized on it very well. And we don't talk much about what's going to happen, but essentially what's been happening for a long time now is an ethnic cleansing in Syria with Putin's blessing. For as long as Assad remains in power, refugees are not going to return. The vast majority of them are not going to return. Or if they do return, they're not going to return to the same place where they were before. So Putin loves to talk about stability, but there will not be true stability for as long as we acquiesce to Putin's designs for Syria and also for the entire region. Because first, Putin doesn't want genuine stability. He benefits from a low level of conflict, not unlike the frozen conflict on Russia's periphery in the former Soviet Union. Because if you have a slow level of conflict, it doesn't require a lot of resources, but at the same time, it necessitates Russian presence. You can justify your presence if you're going to say, well, I'm going to help make things better. And also because the Kremlin has no desire or ability to carry out a genuine reconciliation process in Syria or elsewhere, or help people fundamentally resolve grievances. So that's frankly, this is something that's important to watch in Libya as well, because in Libya there's a lot of unresolved grievances as well, and people who had no history in knowing how to do that, they don't know how to handle these issues. To conclude, I expect Putin to remain engaged in the Middle East, especially in Syria, but also everywhere else in the region, and I think he will always look for ways to step into vacuums wherever the West retreats. If America regains its leadership position in the region, that will be the best way to reduce Putin's influence. Without it, I think we're just going to have more instability and chaos, short-term fixes that will lay out the groundwork for greater conflict. So on that note, I think I will conclude, and I will look forward to your questions. Thank you.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Anna Borshevskaya will now answer questions from the audience.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I wanted to start with just a question that I had while we're collecting questions from the rest of the room, and go back to the first part of your talk on the history of Russia and what that means for the future. And my question is, given the history that you've recounted, can you see a set of conceivable circumstances that would permit democracy to flourish in Russia, or are we stuck with authoritarian Russia for the rest of the future of the world?
Well, I think I think certainly Russia can become a democracy. I don't see it becoming a democracy under Putin, but I think there's no reason why it can't become a democracy. Again, look, the Bolsheviks were an extremist group. This is a fascinating part of that early history. They were a fringe movement that initially had very little support, I think with the right type of leadership, I certainly don't see why Russia can't become a democracy. It will take time, but it's possible.
Well, what circumstances would change then in order for, Putin leaves, he names his successor. What's it going to take?
It would take a pro-Western leader, somebody like Boris Nemtsov, who, as you know, was assassinated recently in the Kremlin, but people like Nemtsov, who believed Russia belongs in Europe, Russia should be part of the West. If you're asking me if I can think of a person right now, no, I don't see such a person. Alexei Navalny certainly is an interesting figure to watch. He has spoken out a lot about Russian corruption. He's uncovered a lot of corruption scandals within the Kremlin circle. First, it's unclear if he's either going to be allowed to run for presidency in the first place. So in terms of what's playing out right now in Russian politics, it's a bit of a charade with a new candidate who is actually Putin's goddaughter, who is supposedly representing the opposition, to create a veneer of competition and legitimacy. So in terms of, who might that be, perhaps the Liberal Party Yabloko might put forth a candidate, but But I'm thinking a little bit broadly. I'm talking about an overhaul of a whole system. And until the whole system of that is built, that Putin has built, is gone, and you have liberals in the Kremlin, then you can talk about building a democracy, sure.
Okay. Thank you. I don't think I'm as optimistic, but here's a group that seemed to be similar, and that's related to what Putin's interests are in expanding his territory or causing instability in the near regions. One is, why do you think Putin seems to have limited his conquest of the Ukraine to the relatively small slice that he sees so far? Another one is, how vulnerable do you think the Baltic nations, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, are to incursions of Putin if he feels pressure? And finally, if Putin needs a quick and easy war, where might he look next? So it's all kind of, sure. What are his...
So Ukraine, why did he take a small slice? Well, Crimea, it was important for a lot of reasons, including a port, frankly, including a port. But also, frankly, for practical reasons, a small piece of territory is a lot easier to take than a big piece of territory, right? Look at how this has played out. First, he annexed Crimea. Then he went into eastern Ukraine, basically to distract from what he had done. And so when we're now talking about Ukraine, Russia has yet to even admit that they have... that they have troops in Ukraine. We're talking about something as basic as implementing a ceasefire. We're not even talking about returning Crimea to Ukraine anymore. Granted, we believe it is part of Ukraine, and we talk about its return sort of an aspirational way. But in terms of practical steps, we're now talking about something smaller. And I think he was, you know, it's a testament, unfortunately, to how well he was able to spin this situation. In terms of the Baltics, how vulnerable are the Baltics? Because I've had my eyes on the Middle East for the last couple of years, I don't follow the Baltics very closely. But I do think the Baltics, on the one hand, are vulnerable to Russian propaganda, to the Kremlin propaganda, the way all of the post-Soviet space is. I also think that a membership in NATO gives a very big advantage. And Russia does take NATO quite seriously. So they're not going to want to have a direct military clash. Instead, they're going to look perhaps for ways, carve out a piece here and there, see if they can see instability on the periphery here and there. And that, of course, does make that region vulnerable. But at the same time, he's not going to want a direct military confrontation. It's a fight he knows he'll lose. And I'm sorry, what was the last question that was on? Where might we look next, right? So I think Libya is another is a place to watch, because depending on what might happen in the year ahead in terms of what the UN does in deciding the future of its government, it looks like a good candidate for at least an increased Russian presence, put it that way. Certainly Putin's, the Kremlin has eyed ports in Libya as well. Frankly, Russia lost billions dollars worth of energy and other contracts in Libya with Gaddafi's deposal, and they're eager to get it back. But the way the situation is playing out right now, European nations, especially Italy, doesn't want refugees. Their major concern is the refugee flow coming out of Libya. But America is not really engaged in this country. And from a certain perspective, if a Russia can bring a short-term fix, as long as some in the West acquiesce to it, that's really all Putin would need to step in. And Haftar is not somebody who can bring true stability to the country. He's a very divisive figure, and you might have another short-term fix that would see instability down the road.
Well, let's stick then with the Russia's a little farther than the near abroad, but not too far. One here and there, two about Turkey. One, what about Russia and Turkey? And the other, what future do you see for Russia's relations with Turkey? Do they now see Turkey as an ally, or as a buffer, or as a long-term, enemy on their border?
Thank you for the question. What I see happening, what I've been observing for the last several years, is Turkey falling deeper and deeper into the Russian sphere of influence. Perhaps more so than even Erdogan himself might realize. Early on, Putin and Erdogan were very close. They certainly share a lot of similarities in terms of authoritarianism, jailing journalists, and so forth. But Erdogan's country is much more fragmented and fragile. Erdogan himself, just in terms of his temperament, is a lot more emotional. Putin is a lot more cool-headed. Turkey has had really no choice but to accept Russia's position in Syria. The one issue of disagreement between Erdogan and Putin has always been Assad's future. Erdogan wanted Assad to go. Well, no longer does he make this demand. And one reason for that is because of Russia's relationship with the Kurds. This is also a very historic, long-standing relationship that goes back to about 200 years, frankly, Catherine the Great, if I recall correctly. Russia always used the Kurds against Turkey, and they're doing that now as well. At the same time, as you know, Turkey is talking about selling the S-400s to Turkey, and it's an incredible thing if you think about it, a NATO ally purchasing not just any Russian weapon, but an S-400. It's unclear whether or not that's going to happen, although I wouldn't discount it. If nothing else, it shows you again how much influence Putin has been able to wield over a Western ally. And it's not just symbolic, it's quite real.
Thank you. Let me switch gears a little bit here and ask one. There's, again, a number of similar or questions on the same general topic. One is, what will it take for the Russian people to embrace an opposition party? Second, what is Putin's strength at home? Is it growing or weakening? And is Putin driven more by a desire to sustain and expand his personal power as the Russian world leader or by a vision for reestablishing Russia's place in the geopolitical hierarchy? So it's kind of, where does Russia stand and where
sure.
is it going?
Sure. Okay. I think, my answer to Putin's popularity, I think an honest answer is that we truly don't know because I think Putin himself doesn't believe the 80% approval ratings. He's constantly asking his pollsters to run another poll. And if you truly are confident that people support you, you don't need constant reassurances. Major protests continued to break out in Russia. It's hard to tell. Another issue is when people say they support Putin, oftentimes they just don't see any other alternatives to him. This dichotomy of stability versus chaos that he presents, it's very strong, especially because many still remember the 1990s. What would it take for the Russian people to embrace a pro-Western, a democratizing leader? I think it would take a long time, and it would take a lot of reckoning with what's happening in Russia. It would take a lot of truth, if that makes sense, because I think an average Russian is just very confused. Both about the Soviet past and also about what their current government is doing right now. What would take, if the massive propaganda machine was gone, or if there was a way, if we countered it in some capacity much more effectively than what we've done, than the way we've done now, with time, I think that would be possible. In the 90s, people were, the Russian people were willing to embrace democracy. They just, they didn't know what it was, and many confused freedom. I think there was an expression, freedom and sausages. There was a misunderstanding of whether you're talking about political freedom or economic development. Many simply wanted economic development. They wanted to put food on the table. Oftentimes, these go hand in hand. So I think, you know, my somewhat rambling answer is I think it would take a long time and a lot of changes. But with I don't think we should close the door on it because when given an opportunity, I think they very well can choose the right leader.
And there's one on Russia and China. Could you comment on the relations between China and Russia under Putin? Where do tensions arise? How much military cooperation exists today or is likely to exist in, as we go forward?
Putin, so the real threat to Russia is not NATO. The real threat to Russia is China. I suspect the Kremlin knows it, and that's why they don't talk about it. That's why they talk about NATO all the time. And that's because China is economically a lot more powerful. It has a larger population, and frankly, in the Far East, it is slowly overtaking the Russian population. Publicly, of course, Putin reaches out to China. There was an energy deal that Russia and China concluded several years ago, but frankly, it was on terms that were very disadvantageous to Russia. I believe, if I recall correctly, this happened in the context of sanctions when Russia turned further east. So the relationship is, you know, on the surface of it, it would appear that these are two authoritarians that get along. But there's a lot more tension underneath. And again, I suspect the Kremlin very much worries about China's rise.
And then just one final question, and we couldn't let you get away without having you comment on Putin and our President Trump. And is Putin playing with Trump as an amateur in international geopolitics? It's a great one.
Well, I think Putin understood. Putin, I think, always understood how to play Western leaders. I think, frankly, Trump is probably not the only one. Certainly, Putin. You saw in the beginning he used a lot of flattery against Trump because he saw that that's what he responded to. The short answer to the question is, yeah, of course he's playing. Of course he's playing Trump. But don't forget, he also played President Obama. He played other Western leaders as well. Frankly, it's a bipartisan approach that he takes to our politics. When it comes to Syria, in particular, into the Middle East, frankly, I don't see much of a difference. In terms of, if anything, I see a continuation from Obama to Trump, and so I also see continuation on the Putin side. He'll play whoever is in charge.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Anna Borshevskaya, the Ira Weiner Fellow at the Washington Institute, who discussed Russia's place in modern world affairs. She recently spoke at the Midcoast Forum at Point Lookout in Northport. If you missed part of the program or you want to hear it again, you can always listen to the program by accessing it on our website, mainpublic.org. Just click on Radio to access the program, and you'll find many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. And for Speaking in Maine, I'm Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.